Okay, it's 2 o'clock. Let's get started. Can you hear me in the back row? Right. So the microphone should be on. Are there any questions? So I've put this slide up before. This is just about tutorials. Yes?
Where's the tutorial blog of the website?
Sorry?
Where's the tutorial blog of the Inf1 website?
Where are the tutorials on the Inf1 website?
It was there yesterday, but it's not there now.
It wasn't
today.
It's
not
now. Did they go away? On my homepage, I've got the, teaching, Informax 1, functional programming. So here's the web page, and let's see, course description, lectures, drop-in labs, tutorials. Tutorial groups with times and places can be found here. There you go.
The actual exercise for this week.
Oh, you want the tutorial exercise for this week? It vanished, did it? Oh, yeah, it should be right there. Ah, I know why it vanished, thank you. When I put this in, I probably didn't synchronize the updates properly, so that vanished. I can put it back. Thank you. So the tutorials for the exercises for this week will appear here, right next to the lectures for this week. Very good question, thank you. Where did my tutorial go? Right, any other questions? Yes?
When will the solutions be published?
When will the solutions be published? Never. No, I think we will publish the solutions early this week. We tend to put them up and then take them away again because the solutions are too easily available. People tend to just look at the solutions, which of course is not the best way to learn. But having done it, having a sample solution to look at can be helpful. So those will go up. We probably, this year we're doing a set of remedial tutorials, so we probably won't put them up until after that. I'll say more about those in a minute. Okay, any other questions? Okay. So this is all completely obvious, and I apologize for putting it up, but last week when I went to my tutorial, I had two people who showed up having done no work at all. This was despite jumping up and down, and despite writing here, do the tutorial work before, italic, blue, the tutorial, exclamation mark. Still had one person showing up saying, oh, I thought I was supposed to do it in the tutorial. So I'm not really sure what to do about that. Right? I've done everything I can to say, be sure you do the work before the tutorial. Let's see. I will try. So the main thing is I want to just ask you, if you have suggestions for how to communicate this information more effectively. Currently, it's not being communicated effectively. I don't know why. I'm doing my best. If you have suggestions, do let me know. Come up to me after class. Drop me an email. Any suggestions for how to communicate to people you actually have to do the work would be appreciated. And along those lines, just in case this hasn't gotten into anybody, okay, I will jump up and down. Guess what? If you don't do the tutorial work, if you don't do the tutorial work before the tutorial, if you, oh, I thought you were rushing out of the room to do the tutorial work. If you don't do the tutorial work before the tutorial and print it out so your tutor can see what you've done and help you with it, if you don't do those obvious basic things, you will fail. It's that simple. It's that simple to do the work, and it's that simple that if you don't do the work, what will happen is you will fail. I have one request. If you're going to fail, drop the course. then you don't count as a bad statistic for us. Right? I would like to see everybody in here pass the course. There's no reason you can't. We have lots of support that we put in place for you to pass the course. All you need to do to pass the course is work very hard and understand what we're telling you. And we put the mechanisms in place so you've got the resources to do all of that. Showing up to class on time helps too. Okay, so that's all fairly obvious. I apologize for belaboring the obvious. Are there any questions about that bit? Now, in terms of providing resources, we know from last year that some students find the tutorials hard going. So if you've done all the work and if you're finding it hard going, we have two extra additional tutorials. I've written remedial, but I think we decided to call them additional tutorials available. One of them is, I left off an important bit. I said Monday and Tuesday. I forgot to tell you what times. I will fix the slides and put that back in. But the one Monday is at 1 o'clock, and the one Tuesday is at 2 o'clock. If you think quickly, you will realize that you're probably too late to go to the one today at 1 o'clock. That's all right. We didn't hold it this week. It will start next week. But the Tuesday 2 o'clock tutorial, taught by Phil Scott, which is in Appleton Tower, this building, room 305, 2 o'clock tomorrow. Anybody who wants to go to that is welcome to do so. Of course, if you all go, you're going to have trouble fitting into the room. But we hope that there will be enough tutorial available for those people who want it. So any questions about the additional tutorials? So as I've said before, the tutorials are very important. Do take advantage of them, and do take advantage of the additional one if you want to. Here's the information from before on the drop-in labs. It's no longer lab week, but the labs are open every week. There are demonstrators there every week. I encourage you to go make use of the labs and make use of the demonstrators. Also feel free, right? One reason we don't have marks assigned to these is so it's perfectly fine for you to talk to each other and get help from each other. Do feel free to make use of the other students that are there and help each other out. The only important thing when you're doing that, of course, is if somebody's helping you, make sure that you understand how to do it yourself. Because when the time comes and you're sitting at the exam, you'll have to do it on your own. Of course, the reason you're here is to learn how to do it, not to learn how, not to get the other person to do it for you. But you know, do get people to help you. That's great. Okay. And this is the required reading. You've seen this before. How many people have the textbook now? Excellent. How many people have read up through last week's readings, chapter 4, 5, and 7? Ooh, not nearly as good. Okay, and how many people have done this week's reading? Almost the same set of people. Okay, so it's great you've all got the textbook. Guess what? It won't do you much good unless you read it. So do read and keep up in the textbook. Notice that the class test is not next Monday, but a week from next Monday. So you need to have enough mastery of the material to actually be able to do the problems during the class test in a couple of weeks. So that's one reason you need to be doing the tutorials. Yes, question. Oh, good question. Is the class test written or electronic? You do it in here, so it's written. It would be nice if we could do it in the labs, but the scheduling for that and so on is impossible. We will have a mock test that you do in the labs just the same as the final exam before the final exam.
Hand?
you will have a final exam. You may ask, but I don't have it memorized, so I can't tell you. And I think possibly the precise day has not been allocated. Yes? Yes, there are loads of past class tests posted online. You're welcome to look at those and study them. Any other questions? Okay. Booleans and characters. That's dull, I'm going to skip it. Conditionals and associativity. Any questions about booleans and characters? Booleans are true and false? Okay. So I'm going to skip over that. These notes are online, right? Anybody is welcome to go look at them and come back tomorrow with a question about booleans and characters. That would be great. But there's a lot of material to get through, so I thought I would leave that for later if there's time, because that's the least important thing to spend our time on. Okay, conditionals and associativity. So here's characters again, in fact. One of the things that you've already looked at in the labs, I think most of you have used this function, digit to int or int to digit for some of the exercises. So digit to int takes a character and return an int. And what it does is its argument is a character C. This is a guard. So it only applies the equation if this condition is true. So if C is a digit, that's 0, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, but not a letter or not a punctuation mark or a space. And characters in the computer are represented by numbers. So ORD converts a character from the type character to the corresponding integer that represents it. And the important thing to know is that the digits 0, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 are represented by sequential character codes. So I can't even remember. Whoops. Oh, this is what happened. I went backwards. That's why I'm doing something dull. Right, so this is the material I wasn't going to cover. So this will convert a character to its character code. And then if it's zero, right, if you subtract the character code for zero from the character code from zero, you get zero. So zero translates to zero. The character code for one is one greater than the character code for zero. So if you do this subtraction, you get 1, and so on. So this is the key trick to converting between characters and integers. Any questions about that? So now I'll cover all I want to. Max! Oh, yes, question. Oh, very good question. What would happen if different computers stored the characters with different codes? Wouldn't you get different answers on different computers? Well, we're only depending on the fact that certain of the codes are sequential. So as long as they always stored them sequentially, we'd be OK. But this is absolutely right. You do need to be very careful about things that work differently on different computers. This is also why standards are important. So in fact, the name for the character codes we're using is who knows what the name is? ASCII. And I can't remember off the top of my head what ASCII stands for, but somebody will. Yes. Thank you. ASCII stands for American Standard Code for Information Interchange. But despite having American in it, it's actually an international standard. And pretty much all computers adhere to the ASCII standard. So we're OK. There's a bigger standard called Unicode, which represents not just the Latin characters, but Chinese characters and Greek characters and so on. But ASCII is a subset of Unicode. So even if it adheres to Unicode, it will still adhere to ASCII. So fortunately, this is a standard that all computers adhere to, and we're OK. There's an important thing to know about standards. Here's the one saying you will always hear about standards. It's good to have standards because there are so many of them to choose from. Right? And what that means is, in fact, there are often competing standards. And when different standards are chosen, then you get into exactly the problem you were describing, that things will behave differently on computers obeying different standards. Right now, everybody uses ASCII. But in the old days, there was a commercial rivalry. And there's another code called EBCDIC, which was IBM's character encoding. And some computers used EBCDIC, and some used ASCII. And when you moved between them, you got into troubles. Right? This is not a problem. This is a problem that's especially difficult for computers, but it's not unique to computers. Right? You'll know other examples of differing standards. For instance, English units and metric units. It's a common example of different standards. And you know that that can cause problems, right? One Mars rover was lost because at some point one person had written a bit of the program using English units and somebody else had written the program using metric units. And something that was given in English units was assumed to be metric units, and that was way off. Bye-bye, spaceship. Okay? So getting standards right is very important. That was an excellent question. Max, right? Most obvious thing in the world, you want to find the largest of two numbers. So that's easy to do. We'll use guards, the max of x and y. If x is greater than or equal to y, it's going to be x. If y is greater than or equal to x, then pick y. So you can see very easily that given two integers, this will return the largest of the two. Oh, what happens if x and y are equal? Both guards are true. What happens then? So Haskell happens to be designed so that if both guards are true, it always picks the first one. You should ignore that. You should design your program so that if both guards are true, it doesn't matter which one it picks. And then you don't need to worry about the order. So in fact, if both guards are true, that will be because x is greater than or equal to y, and y is greater than or equal to x. And that only happens if x and y are equal. So it doesn't matter whether you return x or y, they will both be the same. So this is, in fact, a well-designed program. So now, let's say you want to find the biggest of three integers. How would you do that? Well, let's see. The biggest will be x if x is bigger than y and x is bigger than z. The biggest will be y if y is bigger than x and y is bigger than z. And the biggest will be z if z is bigger than x and z is bigger than y. So it's very clear that this always returns the biggest. And if you think about it for a minute, you will realize that, in fact, one of these three conditions will always be true. There is always at least one biggest number to return. So this is correct code and fairly easy to read. But let's look at some other variations on how you could write that. One thing that you can do in Haskell is you can write otherwise in front of the last equation, and that means if no other equation works, pick this one. And in fact, otherwise is just defined to be true, the Boolean true. Right? Every time you write a guard, it's just an expression like any other expression whose value is a Boolean. That is, it will be true or false. And so just writing true means pick this. So using otherwise is the one exception to always pick things so that the order doesn't matter. Because you've said otherwise, you're indicating to the reader, I expect this equation to be picked if no other equation applies. So that's a different way of writing the same thing. You're free to use either one. Another way of doing the same thing is to use conditional expressions, if then else. So if then else, if you have an integer valued one, this will be a Boolean expression. Any Boolean expression will do. And then these two can be any expressions that are both of the same type, and it's that type that will be returned by the if then else. So another way of saying the maximum of x and y is to say, if x is greater than y, then x, else y. Now to see why this one works, you need to know that, well, if x isn't greater than or equal to y, then y must be greater than x, and so returning y is an okay thing to do. Similarly, you can do max of x, y, z by saying, well, if x is greater than or equal to y and x is greater than or equal to z, and is this operator that given two Booleans returns a Boolean, then return x. Otherwise, else, if y is greater than or equal to x, and y is greater than or equal to z, then return y, else return z. So you can see that what this is doing is going to be exactly the same as what this is doing. First applies this test. If it's true, it returns x. Then it applies this test. If it's true, it returns y. And if neither of those tests returns true, it'll return z. Yes? If the first if is correct, it'll stop, return that, never look at the next one. Correct. And in fact, this has the same property. Right? It goes through them in order and picks the first one that works. But you should ignore that and pretend it goes through them in random order and picks the first one that works. Okay. Any questions about that? Now, if you looked at this, you can see, oh, these tests are kind of repeated. Because here I've said if x is greater than or equal to y, so if this isn't true, look, then we do the test again. Is y greater than or equal to x, right? Essentially, unless they're equal, this one's true if and only if this one is false. So we could compress those into one test, like this. If x is greater than or equal to y, then if x is greater than or equal to z, then x, else z. Otherwise, now we know y is bigger than x. If y is bigger than z as well, then y is the biggest. Otherwise, z is the biggest. Why is z the biggest? Let's see. If this is false, then y is bigger than x. And if this is false, then z is bigger than y. So z is bigger than y. And y is bigger than x, and therefore z is bigger than both y and x. So that's why it's correct to return z. So this is shorter and more efficient code. This is what we should write all the time, right? Nod your head if you think I'm right. Okay, some of you were suckered in by that. I saw some people nodding their head. No. No, don't write it this way. Even though it's more efficient. Why? Because this is a lot harder to read, isn't it? It's a lot harder to tell this is correct. Why are we returning z here? I had to go through this convoluted reasoning to explain to you why z is the correct thing to return here. Look at this code. Why are we returning z here? Because z is bigger than x, and z is bigger than y. So z is the biggest one. Easy! Why are we returning, whoops, not that one. Why are we returning z here? Well, because this test failed, so y is greater than x. And this test failed, so z is greater than y. So z is greater than y, and y is greater than x. So by the transitive law, z is greater than x. So z is bigger than all of them. So that's why it's safe to return z here. Right? It's a lot more reasoning. Now, this is four lines of code, right? Pretty soon, all of you will be masters of programming, and you will have no trouble with four lines of code. And the fact that this takes twice as long to work out as the other one won't matter to you very much. But multiply that by the same sort of thing done again and again and again, and then you will realize that it makes the program a lot harder to read. Right. And your first goal is make the program easy to read. That's because most programs aren't written by a single individual. They're written by teams of people, and you want to work well as a team. Right? I mentioned to you the thing to keep in mind. Pretend the next person that needs to write your code is a psychopath who knows where you live. Right? In fact, who's most likely to be the next person to read your code? You. Maybe much later, after you've forgotten what the code does. Who do you not want to piss off? You. Right? It's a silly idea to make yourself mad at yourself. So, write your code so that you can easily read your code, and so that everybody else can easily read your code. Yes?
So you're practically saying that writing more is better?
Writing more is better. Not necessarily. Writing clearer is better. If you need to write more to be clearer, then writing more can be better. Usually, but not always, writing less is clearer. Write whatever is clearer. Yes?
Why don't we just comment on the code?
Why not just comment on the code? What comment would you write? It does say that.
Okay, for this one it's not even necessary, but if it's something more complicated, we can just comment on it.
Uh-huh, and how will you know that what the code actually does and what the comment do match up?
Well, I've tested it before.
How do you know? You're reading somebody else's code. How do you know it's been tested before? Right. So this is a very good question. Why don't I just comment the code? By all means, write comments if the comments will make things clearer. But it is much better to write clear code than to write clear comments. Right? If you're reading the code, you know that that's what it does. You will all soon discover that you will read comments that are incorrect. Right? Somebody thinks the code does such and so, but it doesn't do such and so. You will spend lots of your time checking that the code actually corresponds with what the comment says it should do. So clear code will still help you perform that check. Excellent question. But the answer is comments are not a panacea. You want to make the code as clear as possible. That's your best bet. Comments are what you do when you can't make the code so clear that just reading it is obvious what it does. So here's some bullet points to summarize what I just said, right? As always, the golden rule, write your program in a form that is easy to read. Don't worry yet about efficiency, right? Premature optimization is the root of evil. Lots of you, I'm sure, are really used to writing your code in a form that performs no superfluous tests. But that's not the best thing to do. The best thing to do is to make your code clear. Right? Conditionals are your friend. Right? Without conditionals, we couldn't even write something like Max. You need the computer to make choices all the time. And the great thing is, right, with conditionals, you can get your computer making literally millions of choices per second. This is both what is great about computers. They can make millions of choices per second for you, and what's very scary about computers. If it's making millions of choices per second, how can you be sure it got it right? This is why testing and also theorem proving is so important. So conditionals are your friend, but also conditionals are your enemy, precisely for testing. Right? If you have just one conditional, then to test your program, you need to make sure you take both branches. You'll have to try each choice at least once. If you have two conditionals, that means the minimum you can get away with is four tests, right? Because you can go two ways through each of two things. Two times two is four. If you have three conditionals, two times two times two is eight, a minimum of eight tests. So if you have five conditionals in your program, that's a minimum of 32 tests that you need to be sure you've gotten it right. And if you have 10 conditionals in your program, that's a minimum of 2 to the 10th, which is about 1,000 tests that you need to get your program right. So you really want to keep conditionals to the minimum you can to ease testing. All the things I'm going to show you are written with either one or two conditionals, and that's it. Now, so that was how we defined Max 3, right, like this. But compared to Max, this is still pretty complicated. Is there a better way to do it? Yes.
If X is greater or equal than Max of Y and Z.
Okay, we could try to exploit our use with Max and say, well, if X is greater or equal than the Max of Y and Z, then pick X and so on. That would certainly be clear. That's a nice one. I hadn't thought of that. So So you can take that idea one step further and do something even nicer still. We could do recursion for a list of numbers, but let's stick just with three for a minute. Yes? Sorry? Right.
You saw the next slide.
Right, so some of you have seen the next slide already. We can define max 3 by using max twice. First find the max of x and y, and then find the maximum of that and z. Right, this is a lot easier to read than max 3, isn't it? Okay. So this is the point. Sometimes what seems the clearest, right, we worked quite hard to make this clear and easy to read. But this is still very hard compared to defining max 3 in terms of max 2. Now we can make this even slightly easier to read. You're allowed to write max infix. So we can just say x max y max z. This is just max defined as before. So this is by far the best way to find the maximum of three numbers. And notice that now max only has one condition in it. So max is much easier to test than max 3. Right? Max 3 had three conditionals, each with two parts. So that was six different things being conditions being evaluated. We would expect at least 64 tests to check that we'd properly done max 3. Whereas if we do it this way, we can test max with just two tests. The reason that this works is that, remember that infix operators in Haskell are just shorthand for function application. So if you write x max y in back quotes, that's just the same as max x y. Similarly, when you write x plus y, it means the plus function applied to two arguments, x and y. And the way we write the plus function is a plus in parentheses. You write x greater than or equal to y, it's the greater than or equal to function applied to x and y. So this is, again, a principle of uniformity, right? It's very similar to the principle that I talked to you about before, right? It says everything is a function application. And functions are always applied to expressions. Expressions can be anything you want. Later on, we'll learn that the function itself is an expression and can be found any way you want. So it's all extremely uniform. So that's the reason for doing it this way. But it's a little bit of a mind bender the first time you see it. So go like this, if this is perfectly clear. Okay. You didn't go like this. Ask a question. Yeah. Actually, the person next to you, but. Okay. Yes?
So to use max for three numbers, we actually have to write another function, max, that tells us which is the greatest for two numbers. So isn't this more difficult to write another function than just having one?
Right. Having worked out that we could do max 3 in this way, I think what you're saying is, well, look, if I'm in the middle of some other large chunk of program, instead of writing max 3 of x, y, z, maybe I should just write this, x max y max z, and that'll be even clearer. Was that your question? No? Yes.
Shouldn't the function maximum,
like? Yeah, I meant that using this function means creating a new function max.
Yeah. Ah, but you could use the maximum, which takes a list of things. You could. I was pretending maximum didn't exist. You've rumbled me. Yeah, using maximum is another good way of doing this. But I hope that the general principles are still clearer from this example. Yes?
Before we write the first method, shouldn't we prove that max is an associative function?
Ah! Next slide. In fact, you notice I left the parentheses out here. So having left them out, does this mean x max y, and then you maximum that with z, or does it mean y max z, and then you maximum that with x. So these two different ways of parenthesizing it. But in fact, both ways give you the same answer. And you can actually test that out with quick check very quickly. Sorry? Right, so that's why it was okay to omit the parentheses here, because max is associative. Right? You remember the question that you learned, right? Whenever you meet a function, what do you ask? Oh, hello, are you associative? Right? That's the first question you ask of any binary operator. Yes?
And how does the computer read that function without the parentheses?
How does the computer read it? I have forgotten. It's in detail, and I've trained myself that if it ever matters, I put in the parentheses. So there is a particular way that Haskell reads it. It doesn't just say, this is an error, but I treat it as if it says, this is an error, and I always put in the parentheses. So you can look it up in the textbook if you want to, or you can just always put in the parentheses. Good question, though. Okay. And by the way, you know, this explains why infix is so great, right? It's much easier to read x max y max z than it is to read max max x y z or max x max x y z, right? These mean exactly the same thing as these, but this I look at and I instantly know what's going on. This I look at and go, what's that? Oh. Finally, what I do is I go, oh, that means this. That's the way I understand it for myself. So it's much, even though this is shorter, right, infix is a lot clearer. Now, this is just a matter of opinion. You might think differently, which is fine. Let me just check. How many people think this way of writing things, infix, is clearer? And how many people think writing function application normally is clearer? Oh, it's about half and half. Interesting. Okay. So I might actually be in the minority here. Yes?
Depends for the function. For example, if you find that the max function is clear with the second, why would, for example, the motor of the D function, which we are used to write like something divide something else, appear to be used with infix?
I'm not quite sure I follow your question.
I think I understand what you're saying. It depends on how close it is to natural language. Mm-hmm.
Ah, okay. So you, since plus you say in the middle, you'd say plus, but since max you say in front, you want to write it in front. Okay.
Actually it's quite similar. No, actually the same as function composition here.
Right, and this is, of course, just function composition. And sometimes function composition is just what you want. Okay, let's go on. Right, I've already mentioned this, right? When you meet something, you ask, is it associative? Of course, the second question you ask is, does it have an identity? Does max have an identity? Right, this would be something such that some number a, such that a max x is equal to x for every x. Is there something that if you take the maximum of it with that thing that you will always get the first thing? Right, so for integers, it's quite hard. Consider the natural numbers, just the numbers greater than or equal to 0, 0, 1, 2, 3, 4. Is there an identity for max then?
0.
Right? The maximum of 0 and any number greater than or equal to 0 will be that second number. So basically, you want to pick the smallest thing is the identity for max. Similarly, the biggest thing is the identity for min. You don't always have a smallest thing or a biggest thing. So max and min do not always have an identity. So I'm going to move on now for max and min. Are there any other questions about that? Yes? Good for you. Right. He just said, could you go over identity again? Because it went past too fast for him. Please be sure to ask questions like that when something goes by too fast for you. That's exactly what you should be doing. So the identity law for max would be this, just like the identity law for zero is this. Right? If you add zero to anything, you get back what you started with. If you, one is the identity for multiplication, because if you multiply something by one, you get back where you started. And so we want something that no matter what it was you took the maximum of with that thing, you would get back where you started. And for numbers in general, that's not true. Right? Let's say I picked a really small number, minus 1 million. X could be minus 2 million. The maximum of minus 2 million and minus 1 million is minus 1 million. So this law would not be satisfied. But if I restrict myself only to numbers that are positive or zero, then the maximum with zero will always be X. Right? 1 million maximum zero is 1 million. 3 maximum zero is 3. 0 maximum zero is 0. Minus 1 million maximum zero is 0, but minus 1 million is not greater than or equal to 0. Is that clear? The identity law, the identity is that thing such that you can combine it with a binary operator and get back where you started. So here, 0 is the identity for max, 0 is the identity for plus, 1 is the identity for times. Right, if we only had the number minus infinity, that would be, then we would have something that works as an identity for maximum. And sometimes people add minus infinity as a number to their computer system just for that reason. But for the time being, we'll ignore that. Yes?
What is idempotence?
What is idempotence? Oh, you've been reading the slide. An operator is idempotent if... if you do it to itself, you get back where you started. So ampersand, for instance, is idempotent. True and true is true. False and false is false. And for and, there are only two cases to check, so it's idempotent. Max is idempotent. What is the maximum of x and x? X. So an idempotent operator is one that satisfies a law like this. Going to move on. Append. So we've seen append before, but what I didn't tell you was the definition of append. So use through, I've told you anything can be defined using recursion. Therefore, since append can be defined, it must be possible to define it doing using recursion. Here's how you do so. So remember what append says is given two lists, it just concatenates all the elements together. So ABC append DE is ABCDE. Notice that it preserves the order. It's just like list union, except we're preserving the order of the elements, and we're preserving duplicates. So how would we define append? Well, let's work it out. As usual with recursion, there will be two cases. Right? Remember, a list is either the empty list, or it's a non-empty list with a head and a tail. So, we're appending a list to another thing. If it's the empty list, what's the empty list appended to some other list? The other list. Easy. What's a list with head x and tail x's appended to the list y's? What will be the head of the resulting list? We know what the head will be, x. How do we get all the remaining elements? We'll just take all the remaining elements in x's and append them to y's. So look how easy this is. To recursively define appending things, we just say nil append y's is y's, x cons x's appended to y's is x cons onto x's append y's. And let's see how that works out. Stupid computer mode entered. A, B, C, append, D, E. Well, A, B, C, that's just a list. Its head is A, and its tail is a list whose head is B, and its tail is a list whose head is C, and its tail is the empty list. And D, E is similar. So let's see. To work this out, I just work out which of these two equations apply. So here's my first element, my first argument. Here's my second argument. So So this appended to this. So the first question I ask is the first argument the empty list? No. Is the first argument a non-empty list? Yes. X will be ahead. That's, help me out here. A. X's will be the tail. That's, the tail is the list B cons on to C cons on to nil. BC is the tail. Okay, so now I just copy this out with X replaced by A. I put in the parentheses, they're very important. Here they are. And X's is replaced by the tail, B cons C cons nil. And I append that onto Y's, which is this list here, DE. Then we do it over. B cons C cons nil appended to DE. First equation doesn't apply. Second equation applies. So X will be B. And x's will be c cons nil. I just copy it out with the x first, and then c cons on to nil is the tail. And I do that again, I get the c at the front. And then finally, I've got the empty list here. So empty list appended to de is just de. Now, here's the same thing where I've written the list a bit more compactly. This is a lot easier to read, right? Just means the same thing. So A, B, C, the head is A, so we copy the A out. The tail is B, C, so we append that to D, E. B, C append D, E. The head of B, C is B, so we put, whoops, so we put B at the front. The tail is the list C, so we append that to D, E. C append D, E, the head is C. The tail is the empty list, so we append the empty list to D, E, and then empty list appended to D, E is D, E. We've got the list whose head is A, and whose tail's list whose head is B, and whose the list whose head is B, and whose tail is the list whose head is C, and whose tail is the list DE. So that's A, B, C, D, E. So that's how append works. Easy. Append is an infix operator. What's the first question you're going to ask? Is it associative? Is it associative? Oh, good. Give me a counterexample. Right? If it's not associative, you'll be able to find three specific lists. If you append them one way, they'll give you one answer. If you append them the other way, you'll get a different answer. Sorry? So your counterexample is that A append B is not the same as B append A, right? And that's true, because this is AB, this is BA, and they're distinct, so they're not equal. But is this a counterexample to the associative law? No, this is a counterexample to the commutative law. You are correct. Append is not commutative. Associative says three things parenthesized each of two ways. So for instance, here's a possible counterexample. AB plus CD plus EF Right, that would be the same. Well, first we do this, and we get A, B, C, D. And then we do this. And then we would do them all together, and we'd get A, B, C, D, E, F. The other way of parenthesizing it, would be like this.